The following interview with General Alex Carrington by Wayne Burr took place in Arlington, Virginia on February 10, 1988. The interview is part of a joint project by the Columbia University Oral History Research Office and the Foundation for Iranian Studies.
General, would you like to make a statement before we start out with the questions on the issues of U.S.-Iran relations?
All right. Major Ellis W. Williams, son, U.S. Army retired. Major General Ellis W. Williams. 10th of February, 88. When I was first assigned, or learned that I was being assigned to Iran, I went there with a chip on my shoulder for probably three different reasons. First of all, I knew very, very little about Iran. And I realized that I was being sent over there as the chief of the military mission and personal advisor to the Shah of Iran with relatively little background as far as the culture and the people. Concern. The second reason was the fact that I already had been given indication that I was being given a three-star assignment, and that was being changed because of a special meeting between the Chief of Staff and the Shah of Iran, and they had decided that they wanted a different type chief of mission than the previous one, and I was flattered by being told that, well, they would just put my promotion off for a couple of years, but this was a fabulously wonderful opportunity for me and for the service. And the third reason, I think, was the fact that in my initial briefings, at every turn, whether it was at the Department of Defense, the Department of State, the CIA, everywhere I went for my preparations, I was told what a brilliant man the Shah of Iran was. Just the smartest man that ever lived. And my comment was, well, certainly he looks smart. He's been king for over 30 years. And if someone brings up a subject he's not familiar with, all he has to do is change the subject and talk on something else. I said, a man in that position should look not to anyone. So I went over there somewhat opposed to going and not thinking as positively as I should. After being over there just a very short time and a half a dozen or so private meetings with the Shah, I became a total convert. I became thoroughly convinced that he was probably one of the most brilliant men I'd ever met. He had his near total recall of any person I know of. He could understand the essence, the meaning of a group of facts very quickly. On top of that, he was an extremely immense person. It absolutely amazed me that anyone could have been for that long and still maintain the ability to listen. He was truly interested in learning new things or understanding the reasoning behind things. So I, as mentioned, became a convert, having been pretty sore about the whole thing initially. But to understand the way the Persian psyche works, we need to understand that the Iranians are thinking, living, completely immersed with their heritage. They don't think Iran. They think the Persian Empire. And if they visualize the Persian Empire, they swing around the Mediterranean all the way to include Ethiopia. They look north up both sides of the Caspian Sea, at least a couple hundred miles into what is now called Russia. They think much larger than just Iran. And they think of their culture as having been, in ages past, well ahead of the rest of the world and setting the pace for the rest of the world. They pride themselves in being originated the idea of human rights. They claim that the Persian Empire had no slaves in it. They claim that they were benevolent leaders to such an extent that they were really loved by their subjects. So they're living in the past. Now, the years since, the years of 2,500 years of a continuous monarchy, as they visualize themselves, they realize that it includes much loss of territory, many invasions, many encroachments on their culture, many forced beliefs, but they still think of themselves as similar to the Greeks, that their culture is so strong that it has survived adversity. And they have no doubt in their mind but what the Persian culture will survive and will rise and will dominate in time, until you realize that they expect, they fully expect the Persian culture to come up over and above everything else on earth. That's what they believe, and if you don't accept the fact that they believe it, then you don't understand. They have a lot of quirks in their personalities. They believe in their religion. I'm sorry to use the word quirk, that's not quite correct. They do believe in their religion, and they believe in it literally to such an extent that they are looking forward to the opportunity of dying for their country. They revere their so-called martyrs, those who have died in the service of their religion and in the service of their country. They revere those martyrs over and above everything. It's fact. The women are pleased when they hear that their sons have died for the service. Until you accept that, you don't understand. I have a lot of little things that we can talk about later. But the Iranians, as they look at themselves, beginning about 1955, 1968, 1960, along in there, went through a transition, and then under the Shah of Pahlavi, they started what they call the White Revolution. The White Revolution was not a bloodletting battle. There were almost no deaths, tragedies, physical conflicts, and things of that sort. There were some tribal banging back and forth, and things of that sort. But they thought of themselves as bringing their country back into the, what they called it, the community of advanced nations. They thought in terms of coming back into this community by a parallel improvement in 12 different fields. And surprisingly enough, military was not one of them. They were looking to education, to sanitation, to medicine, to industrialization, things of that sort. The question the Westerner has The Military was not one album. What caused this fantastic military buildup? The military buildup in the mind, and I discussed this personally with the Shah time and time again, and with many of his assistants. The military in their mind was 100% designed to permit the 12 elements of the white revolution to succeed without outside influence. That's the way they looked at it. You may ask, well, why did they think of me? Historically, again, as I mentioned, the empire was diminished by losing territory. One of the most recent ones is when the Russian Empire decided to come down both flanks of the Caspian Sea. The great port of Baku used to be in Iran. Now one of the large Russian ports. The Russians, by military power, just plain moved down and took it away from them. The Iranians couldn't resist. World War I came along. The Iranians were very, very upset about outside dominance. So they started trying to do everything they could. The British, as you know, at the turn of the century had come in and developed it all. The British had really come in and just about overwhelmed the country and got control of it. Their rail lines, their communications lines, all the system and everything else. And to a great extent, the Germans came in, the Americans came, the French came, and so on. So they were very, very upset about foreign intervention to such an extent that they started passing laws against foreigners, pushing out foreign investments, things of that sort. And of course, the foreign countries didn't want to give up their assets. So developed into a general problem, and I believe it was 1923, about one of them. They signed a pact with Russia. A pact that in effect said that Russia could participate in many things if Russia would help Iran keep European particular nations from dominating Iran. And in signing that treaty, there was a chapter 6. You may have to do some studying on this to be sure you and I have my numbers right. I think I'm correct. There was one chapter in there, a page, that said if a foreign country takes over undue influence in Iran. That's number one. Number two, if the Iranians try to expel the foreign country and failure, and if the Iranians request it, then Russia will come in with the military force and expel the country. Four elements how that agreement is. Mm-hmm. The Iranians now, I think it's called, the Iranians in the late 60s, early years, late 70s, said that chapter 6 was not signed at the time the treaty was signed. That chapter 6 was added after the treaty was signed. It was added in Moscow, and their ambassador was forced to sign it under duress. Now, whether that's right or not, I don't know, but that's the Iranian idea. And I have heard that personally, verbally, from the prime minister, from the minister of war, and from the commander of the Imperial Iranian military staff. I never discussed it personally with the Shah, but I heard it from all three of those, and that's what they thought was right.
Okay. After World War II,
the Russians, as you recall, the Russians came in from the top, and the British came in through the Persian Gulf and blasted the Iranian Navy out of existence, and nothing happened. The British and the Americans and the Russians were using the landmass of Iran as a supply base for the element of the World War II activities coming in from the east. So there was a lot, there were a lot of American producers and Russians in Iran at the end of World War II. And the decision was made that our forces would withdraw and leave Iran to their own assets, and the Americans and the British got out, and the Russians didn't want to leave the Azerbaijan area up in the Caspian Sea area. And as you know, in 1947, our President Truman, in effect, said, "We've got the atomic bomb, and you don't have it, and get the hell out." And that's the only way that the Russians were forced out of Iran at the end of World War II. The Iranians absolutely revered President Truman for taking that stand. And they have always respected, well, for years respected the Americans great deal. But that really put the cap on the Iranians, the leadership, massively what they told the Iranians. The leadership thought that the Americans were just gods almost. They believed in us to a fault. The Americans have sent doctors, educators, all kinds of assistance over there. And the Iranians were very, very appreciative of that. The Russians, since 1947, have several times made rumblings and indicated that they were going to invoke Chapter 6 of the 1923 agreement. And it just scared the hell out of the Iranians. The Iranians do not like the Iranians. They're scared to death of this. And I think that's rather conceivable. When the revolution started, it came as a surprise to a lot of people, but not the Shah. The Shah was expecting it. The Shah had no idea at all that he'd lose. He was fairly convinced that he could prevail. But I'd say on at least 18, maybe 15 times, I discussed with him, he discussed with me, his thought that as you bring a nation along this rapidly, you absolutely must educate the masses. You must give the masses a voice. You must let the masses express themselves and make mistakes. And against a lot of advice, he permitted many, many student activities, even though that's all comes out in what many nations would call dissident activities, because he thought it was helpful. He thought that people would learn responsibility by making mistakes. He's been criticized quite a bit by some people because he would not turn his own weapons on his own people. And I think that when you really look into it, you find that by and large he did not kill someone. By and large, he could have put down that revolution with military strength coming in. What made the revolution succeed? Again, I'm telling you, just one guy's idea. And it is very narrow in its view. It is so narrow that I have a tendency to magnify too much. So take it for what it is. In my judgment, the Shah and his administration fell because of its conflict with religion. Its conflict with religion was created at least 85% through one major point, and that is land reform. Many books have been written on land reform. I think history will show that Iran is certainly one of the few, maybe the only nation that you can name where land reform was actually put into effect nationwide. He created in a period of 10 years literally millions of new land owners. He said that no one individual could own more than, I believe, 160 hectares, which of course we own this open. But in saying that, he broke into the extremely wealthy. Because over there, the owning of property is considerably different from what it is over here. You own a piece of land, that's your land, and you can farm it, you can put a house on it, you can do pretty well. But over there, in addition to owning land, an individual would own an entire community, which included not just the land, but all of the buildings, all of the public buildings, the churches, the schools, the factories, everything. And the landowner told all of the people, peasants as we call them, what to plant, when to plant, when to harvest, where to sell. He took all the income and then he parceled out what he felt was appropriate to give to the peasants. So the land ownership over there had a completely different connotation than what it has, or magnified connotation than what it has over here. Now, why did that hit such a nerve over there? The church is organized very similar to the way the Catholic Church is nationwide. It owns, I mean, country, worldwide. It owned a lot of revenue-producing property. And when the Shah started breaking up these great land holdings, he nipped at the very fiber, the nerve center, of a lot of the religious leaders. And they started telling the relatively unsophisticated people, Shah is against our religion. He is destroying our religion, and the people are so religious that they believe. Sure, a lot of them own new land. A lot of them have never dreamed of owning land before. Now we're landowners. But to challenge my religion is to hit it to the core of my soul. In my judgment, that was the spark plug that pissed off the revolution. And then there was a whale of a lot of emotional organization support in many areas. But in my judgment, the land reform was the key point that broke the revolution into the open and started the snowball. I could talk for another 2 hours, but I think I've given you enough of the background of my personal feelings, where I'm coming from.
One thing I do want to say, though, get back to the military. What did the Shah want to do with the military? He said this time and time again. If there is, turn out your phone, if there is a war between neighboring nations, among neighboring nations, relatively small, regional wars, is what he's talking about, the great powers will step in and stop it. And in that part of the book, we haven't stopped the Iran-Iraqi war. But he says, if, and I'm not looking for a fight, I don't want to fight, but if I have to fight Iraq, Pakistan, or Afghanistan, I'll tell you why he distrusted a little bit there. He said, if I have to fight them, and the great powers step in and stop it, I want to be very sure the ceasefire line is not in my territory. He said, I want to be prepared to absolutely know that it will be a break-even effect. He said, I don't need any of that territory. I don't want any of that territory. But I absolutely refuse to surrender any of my territory to another country. So that was number one. Number two, if Russia decides to come in under the pretext of the 1923 treaty or anything of that sort, if Russia decides to come in and take part of my territory, and make it all out of it, you know, 300 years Russia's been looking for that warm water port, and right down through the eastern, western edge of Afghanistan, Pakistan, and Iran, they could come right to the open sea, Indian Ocean. He says, if Russia decides to do that, I want to ensure that I have the ability to delay them long enough for a scorched earth policy and prevent them from getting anything of that. And he said, that we will do. We are prepared to do. And that message went out to his armed forces throughout the Senate. We will not lose to a neighboring country, and we will not let the Russians or anything like that. So that was his so-called, people call him a warmonger, building up a big military regime. But that was his reason for that. He did not, and I can absolutely guarantee you this, he did not use his country, his military, for internal security. I know that because I was stationed in Tehran. I had 4 airplanes in my command. I'm a pilot myself. I flew my own airplane. I made 2 trips a week outside of Tehran, usually staying overnight each time. So I went to dozens, actually hundreds, of different towns in Iran. I went all over that country. I saw that country probably better than any one human being alive today. I went all over that country. I had a plane with a pressure system on that could land in just anywhere I wanted to fight. So I remember landing on the highway and everything. And the Shah gave me complete carte blanche. Nobody could ask me why I wanted to go. Nobody could tell me not to go. And I went completely unarmed for 2 years in every backwood, big city, little village, tribal village, mountain, desert. I went all over that country. Very frequently took my wife with me, completely unarmed. And I saw no indication of the people being beaten down. So we did not use the military as a maintenance security force. Why was he frightened or concerned that a neighboring nation might be sniffing at him? 90 years ago, about then, a British cartographer drew the boundary between Iraq and Iran in a stupid sort of way. International boundaries all over the world respect natural values. If it is a river, the boundary goes down in the middle of the river, and each side is permitted to use the river. Some British cartographer drawing a map drew the line down the Iranian side of the river. Why is that important? The major seaport of Iraq and Iran have to use that river.
This is the Shatt al-Arab.
Shatt al-Arab. So you have to go up that river to get to the major port of each of the cities, of each of the countries. And as you go on up, the river gets rather small, and the mountains and the trees and forests quite thick and all that. And the guy just drew it. There's no natural line of drawing, which nobody gave a damn about for 50 years. But then when they started discovering oil up in there, every time, and Iran, I think the beginning was taken from Iraq, may have done something, but every time either nation would drill a hole in the ground, if they found oil, both nations claimed that the boundary was on this side or that side. So that created a fight, a fuss, a continuous fuss between Iran and Iraq. And then, to make the matters worse, there's the Kurdish tribe up there that is in northwest Iran and northeast Iraq. The Kurds are across the strait of borders from Iran and Turkey. And the Kurds are independent of us. Devils that don't give a hoot about anybody. So anytime you want to get a fight, all you got to do is go punch him, says your neighbor says you, and then go fight him. So there was a constant stir on the border. So Iran and Iraq have been at it psychologically for 4 years, I guess. In the long run. What about the other side? The communist world, ever since the communists took over in Russia, have been publishing papers and put out big pamphlets on that. About the nation of Baluchistan. The Baluchis are, again, one of those tribes that is on the border. Baluchis live in eastern Iran and western Pakistan and Afghanistan. And the communist world has been planting the seed around there that the Baluchis ought to set up their own nation. And of course that meant if it was a nation set up and if the Soviets were influential among them, that would give the Soviets their openness to the Indian Ocean. So the Shah was fearful that Russia would be successful in stirring up strife with Pakistan or Afghanistan. Well, that was his thought, that I may sometime, not I may, but his armed forces, as far as he was concerned, he did use his armed forces for one other purpose. You can call it an instrument of social reform, you can call it an instrument of industrial development, you can call it an instrument of economic resources of what. He used his armed forces schooling system for educating one hell of a lot of people. He had a draft system. Everybody owed the country so much service. And the service could be rendered in many different ways. It could be rendered through the military, it could be rendered through the medical, and it could be rendered through this, what they call the sanitary corps,
or the literacy corps, which is something they really want to do. The literacy corps was 120,000 strong of teachers. He would go out, these people from the tribes would be brought into high school, and when they finished high school, time for their national service, they could give their national service by going back to teach, usually in their own tribe. So they would go to a pedagogical school, set up for basically 6 months, and then go back and teach for 18 months in their own little campus. They did that a lot. But then in the military side, he took these high school graduates and guys who trained thousands of automobile mechanics, radio technicians, all kinds of little working level skills. And the way he worked his literacy corps and his military together is a person's pay was devised or graduated on two bases. One was, what kind of skill do you have? Are you a mechanical engineer? Do you know how to repair an automobile engine, for instance? And if you knew the basics of that, okay, you had a job doing this. But if you had a 10th grade education, your pay was here. If you had a 12th grade education, your pay was in the place. Doing the same job, but with a better education. So he encouraged education and marketable skills in that way. So he did use the armed forces to some extent in that way, but not for what we normally call an event. Have I talked enough now that already talked longer than I planned to?
But I'll raise questions which we can talk about if we go along.
I feel that I was so close to these people. And I had 40 years in military service. I've been in 71 different countries, I think. I've lived in each one, or some of them. Pull that back all the way, not each one of them. I've lived in a few of them long enough to learn the people, appreciate that culture a little bit. And I think the Iranian people, although many of them are completely what we call unsophisticated, the Iranian people were very happy, the nicest people ever. Worldwide, they are nice people. The only trouble is the masses are unsophisticated, and then they have a characteristic that is true to some extent in Japan and Korea. Basically, they crave excitement. They literally crave excitement. And if something exciting is going on, they just got to get in with it. Got to be a part of it. Right around them, if it's exciting, I've got to. They've often been described as a Cinderella mentality. They just take life as it comes. Poor little Cinderella sits by the hearth. She's in the ashes and she's just not doing much at all. But if all of a sudden there's a possibility that that glass slipper might fit, God, here they go, there. They're pissed off, they're excited, they're thrilled, maybe something's going on. And it's dangerous, it's extremely dangerous, because so many of them are so unsophisticated that they will believe anything that a stranger tells. The last story they hear is true in their mind. I hate to call them children, but many of them are. And when I say that, I am excluding the top 5-6%. The top 5-6% of the Iranians are extremely well educated.
William, that called you, you would be entirely happy to have them in your home, in your church, in your university, in any activity you have. The top few percent of their lungs are wonderful, wonderful. Now,
talked to you almost an hour here.
No, not quite. It was so long.
With an opening statement, almost an hour, just about pounding.
About 30 minutes. The tape's still running, so.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it doesn't run up. It's a 45-minute tape, so. That was a very, very interesting statement. Which I think it raises more questions that we can deal with as we go along. But I thought maybe before we discuss your experience in Iran in detail, it might be good to ask you about your background, so we can learn about the kind of experiences you brought with you to Iran when you were stationed there in 71 through 73. Is that procedure okay with you? Okay. Where were you born and raised?
Born in a little town of Rayford, R-A-E-F-O-R-D, North Carolina, when I was 1 year old. My parents moved to Raleigh, which is the capital city. I was number six of seven children. My father was usually a barber and carpenter. Well, 10th grade education, but he was very well self-educated individual to such an extent that he spent 13 years as the Assistant Secretary of State for the state of North Carolina, of education for the state of North Carolina. Mm-hmm. So he was a very well-educated man, but not from a formal standpoint. My mother was a college degree, taught in the world for a while. So both of them, well, they were sort of on the academic line. My parents' total objective was all seven of their children would have college degrees. We all made it.
Where did you yourself receive your education?
In addition to wanting a STEM college degree, my father had one of these Southern working class ideas that a girl should get a college degree, have a college degree, and her parents should pay for it. No question. A boy should have a degree and he should earn it. My father believed 100% that the value of earning your way through college was just as good. That's the knowledge you learn in your classroom. So out of five sons, he never gave a woman the first dollar as far as education is concerned. But my oldest brother was an electrical engineer and went on to be vice president of Alice Chalmers. My second brother was a mechanical engineer, was quite successful with Bill Hall. He did what he called a known position. His third brother was a mechanical engineer. He went on to be vice president of Veterans Theater. So he did all right. My youngest brother is a medical doctor. He was very successful. My two older sisters were graduating from college. So when it came along for me to go to college, as luck would have it, the banks had just failed, and what little I had saved up to go to school was lost. Not quite all of it lost, but at least deferred to where I could get my hands on it. So I went away to school on a music fellowship. I taught music and conducted little college band. My three older brothers had attended North Carolina State. We lived right on the page of the campus of North Carolina State.
You turn this over. It's off the one.